good evening, and welcome to Bird Calls from the Noel Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Noel Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and the Piney Woods Audubon Society in Nacogdoches, Lufkin, educating people and protecting birds for over four decades. The Piney Woods Audubon Society is seeking new members and meets the first Thursday of each month, September through May. Information is on Facebook at East Texas Piney Woods Audubon. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He's also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he's authored over 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for coming back again.
Thank you, Bill. Happy to be here.
You bet. And this is one show past 5 years for us, so we're kicking along here. Once again, if you have questions tonight, give us a call at 800-552-8502. Any question about birds or the avian world are welcome. That's 800-552-8502. And at the end of last month's program, Cliff, we had a conservation tip. Can you remind us about what that was?
Yes, and we profiled the chimney swift, little brown bird that flutters around, looks something like a bat during the day, and it's somewhat of a pest control agent. He's up there, they're up there eating insects that are pesky. And they're good neighbors to have, and they nest in chimneys. Now, the conservation tip was if you've got an uncapped chimney already, you're in an older house maybe, and you've got chimney swifts, don't be afraid. Again, they're good neighbors to have. Leave your chimney uncapped. If you have a capped chimney and you want chimney swifts, there are blueprints available at chimneyswifts.org on how to build your own chimney swift tower in your yard, or on top of your roof, or in your field, and that way you'd be encouraging these species. So, let me back up a little bit and talk about that. This bird occurred. It would nest in big hollow trees. So, just envision a big tree that two or three people would have to hug, and the top falls out, and all that's standing is this trunk, and it's completely hollow, and that's exactly what chimney swifts were designed to use. Now, we don't let trees get that old that much anymore. If they're in urban settings, of course, we remove them because they might fall on the playscape or the truck. So we get rid of them. So these birds quite smartly have turned to chimneys. And again, we want these guys to continue to be our good neighbors. This isn't one that you'll see making a mud nest. That some people confuse swallows and swifts. This is, again, a swift. They don't perch on wires or twigs. You won't see them sitting on the roof. They're a clinger. They only cling on bark or on a rough surface like your chimney. So the chimney swift, we tied that together with our conservation tip, which, again, is keep your chimney uncapped if possible. And if you have to cap your chimney, which I understand the reason for that, you can do the next step, again, is to go to chimneyswifts.org and look for blueprints on how to build your own chimney swift tower.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And tell us about this month's spotlight bird.
We're going to talk about the wood thrush. No other species in the entire U.S., in my opinion, has a more soothing, exquisite song as the wood thrush, as we'll hear now. Beautiful. The wood thrush also has a distinctive call note that we'll listen to now. Kind of a whip, 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 whip.
Now I hear that a lot where I'm at. I don't hear the song as much.
There are a few birds that make a whip-whip sound like that. This one's real rapid fire, and this is a bird that's going to be calling from the woods. So old-timers refer to the wood thrush as the, quote, Eole bird, which is a great colloquial name because that name comes from the general transcription of what the bird sounds like while singing. Their song is quite ventriloquial as it comes from the shade and the shadows of lush forests, which at times makes this songster difficult to find. Slightly smaller than a robin, this bird has a rusty brown back and white chest and belly covered with large spots, black spots. This species might be confused with the brown thrasher, an uncommon backyard inhabitant, but the thrasher has a much longer tail and sings a very different tune. The wood thrush occurs throughout the Red River radio listening area, as well as the entire eastern U.S., and extends westward to the Great Plains, plus it occurs in the southeasternmost sliver of Canada. This migratory species spends the warmer months with us, where it nests and raises young. In winter, they fly south to Mexico and the rest of Central America. Occasionally, a few might winter along the mild Gulf Coast. In the U.S., the wood thrush needs forests made up of mostly hardwoods, where it forages on the ground, sifting through the leaf litter in search of insects and seeds. They also forage on tasty berries up in trees and shrubs. If you're a longtime lover of this song, yet you don't quite hear it as often anymore, you'll be shocked to hear that the species has experienced a 60% decline, according to nearly 50 years of breeding bird survey data from all across the bird's breeding range in the U.S. and Canada. To see what a wood thrush looks like, please visit the bird calls page at redriverradio.org for beautiful photographs snapped by our very own James Childress of Lufkin.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got two callers online. Leon, please hold on for a few minutes, because first up we've got Patrick from Shreveport. Patrick, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, thanks. I have a quick bird story for you, if it's okay.
Okay.
And a question. Okay, I drive a truck. I'm a long-haul trucker. And about 2 years ago, I was in South Sacramento, California, and I was taking my dog out for a walk, and a cockatiel landed on the ground in front of me. And I tried to find the owner for it. I tried on Craigslist, et cetera, and I could not find the owner. It's definitely a biter. It's a very loving bird. It's a great bird. I couldn't find anyone to take it. There was one person, but they wanted to clip its wings. So now I'm a trucker with a bird. And believe it or not, this bird, I keep it in a huge cage during the daytime. At night, I let it fly around the truck. And I just wanted to thank you for the show. I'm going to check out the wood thrush and play it. Play it for the bird, the wood thrush song, too.
Yeah.
Still trying to find a good home for it. I'm trying to find, you know, a real bird person that has experience with them. They're such finicky birds.
So how long have you had this cockatiel now, Patrick?
Close to 2 years, and it's been to almost every state now.
Oh, man, you can't get rid of him now. He's your brother.
Well, I know, but still, driving a semi-truck is kind of tough. It screams so loud. So I'm doing my best.
Yeah. No, I think he's probably got a good life. They like to form pair bonds. Most parrots and relatives or allies are very social. So if you're there with him all the time, that's the best thing you can do for that bird. You know, he came to you, and I think he did so for a reason. And I think you guys sound like a good pair, Patrick.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, cockatiel lover gave me the same advice. Thank you so much. You both
okay.
Have a great night.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now, and we go next to Leon from Bossier City. Leon, you're online with Cliff. What's your question? Hello, Leon? Leon. All right. Well, Hans, are you there? All right. Well, we lost Leon, so we're going to go on to our next one. Hans, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi. I was just calling because I saw a bigger, it almost looked like a hawk. I saw him from far away, but he had sort of a white belly and a darker rest of his body, and he had swept wings, but he also had a forked tail, and I had never seen that sort of a tail with that kind of a bird, so I was just wondering what that could have been.
Well, the only raptor with a deeply forked tail is the swallow-tailed kite, and it looked like a pair of scissors, that tail?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're tuxedo color. They're black and white, and that long scissor tail is very distinctive. Again, swallowtail kite. Where did you see it? What state or what?
I was here in Bossier, and okay. The reason it caught my eye was because I saw a couple of little birds chasing after it. I don't know what it was, but
okay, yeah. A lot of time raptors are not well thought of by their neighbor birds. And we're reminded constantly in our backyard when the red-shouldered hawks or the barred owl are around, because all the songbirds get after them and mob them. They don't want to be the prey. They try to kick out the predator. But the thing is about swallowtail kites, they don't really eat adult birds. They will get nestlings out of nests, but they're predominantly eating aerial insects, large grasshoppers, large dragonflies. And so they're really insectivorous. So I don't know why the birds are threatened by them, but sometimes other birds just like to be tough and mean. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's cool. So thanks for the call on the swallow-tailed kite.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have four lines open right now, so you can get right in. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have Leon back now. Leon, what's your question for Cliff tonight?
Well, I wanted to thank him for allowing me to understand the difference between a house wren and a Carolina wren.
All right.
And my question is, does that little guy nest more than once a year?
Oh.
I think I've got one in my backyard.
Yeah.
This is the third nest he's built this year.
Yep, that's a great question. And the answer is yes, they do raise multiple broods, the Carolina wrens do. And we're in the same boat. We have probably two-thirds of the way done babies in our back porch right now. And I know this has got to be the second or third nesting. Now, first nest in this certain spot, but I know that they would never initiate nesting this late, so I'm guessing that it's second or third. Now, did all of your nestings happen in the same nest or same locality?
No, in the same area.
Okay.
The back porch.
Yeah, cool. And are you calling from Texas or Louisiana? Where are you calling from, Leon?
Beautiful downtown Bossier.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you called back, because I was thinking that we would have to write a song about how we lost you. So lost Leon would have made a really mournful song.
So, indeed it would.
Yeah. All right.
Really enjoy your show. Thanks for
great.
Going to them.
Thank you, sir.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All of our lines are open right now, so you can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And while we're waiting for our next call, we've had some photos and an audio clip sent in, and we're going to go to the audio clip first. This one came in from Judith Williamson, and she said that she's been hearing this call for the past couple of weeks in West Austin and wanted to know what it was.
And we just got this, or I just heard it, about 30 minutes ago.
Right.
So what's interesting is there's two birds singing there, but I think the prominent one is the white-winged dove, which a lot of people think sound maybe like an owl hooting. But in the background is a white-eyed vireo. So let's keep playing and listening for the two. So the cooing again is the white-winged dove, and then that chick-a-rear-deer-deer-chick in the background is the white-eyed vireo. So there's two birds in there, and maybe that was supposed to be a trick question. I don't know.
You don't know. Yeah, don't know. In her email, she simply put in the subject line, flycatcher? No question mark, but I assume the question mark, so I'm not really sure. But yeah. I hear the white-winged dove all the time at my place.
Yeah.
And I was wondering myself. I tried to capture it a couple. It seems to be microphone shy, so I put my phone out, and it shuts up. But I thought it might have been related to the mourning dove, which has more of a, you know.
The mournful coos. Now, the white-winged dove wasn't around here two or three decades ago. This is a fairly recent invader to the listening area. So if you're an old-timer and you grew up in this area, you didn't hear white-winged doves. It wasn't until probably in the 90s or 2000s that depending on where you live, of course, that you started hearing them. So you definitely didn't hear them in the 60s and the 70s. So
it's not native to this area specifically.
It's naturalized on its own. We would consider that native. It didn't come in here because cages opened up. It moved northward on its own. So it's mostly a Mexican species that has spread northward, mainly because of urbanization. This is a bird that is doing well because of backyards, feeders, shade trees, dog food bowls, bird baths, and they just do very well in urban settings. So as we increase as a species and our urbanization increases, so do things like the white-winged dove and the European starling and the house sparrow and so forth.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our next call, Martin from Lufkin. Martin, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, about 2 years ago, I had a white mockingbird living around my house here in Lufkin.
Cool.
And I was just wondering how rare that was to have a white mockingbird.
That's, let's see, in the terms of the lottery, that would be like maybe a $50 scratch-off win. It's not the big million-dollar winner. So I don't know how else to tell you that it's pretty cool, but, I probably hear about one every other year somewhere in my area, a white one or partially white one. So it's pretty cool. There's also a lot of white chipping sparrows in winter and a lot of white cardinals. And that doesn't mean completely white, but some partial white on those. And the thing that the mockingbird, the cardinal, and the chipping sparrow all have in common is that they occur close to humans, close to our backyard windows where we're looking. So we are going to find those a lot easier than something that's very hard to find, like a brown creeper or a savanna sparrow, something that skulks. So the mockingbird is a common backyard bird, and when there's an oddity like a white one, people are going to find it. And these days, they're going to take a photograph, and then they might even put it online, and sometimes it goes viral. I don't know if some of our listeners were privy to a cardinal in, I think it was in Alabama a couple months ago, that was pure yellow, banana yellow. And that picture went viral, and, we're used to our bright red cardinals. Well, this one had an abnormality that he was all yellow. He's pretty cool looking. One of a kind. I don't think there had been any records since then. But there, if you go online, you'll find lots of pictures of white or very white mockingbirds, cardinals, and chipping sparrows, and goldfinches, too.
I never got a picture. I tried and tried to get a picture of it, but every time I get my camera ready, it's gone.
Yeah.
Well, a couple hours.
And hopefully he's still kicking, so maybe you'll still see him again and can take that picture later. So
this is the first time I've listened to your show, but I've enjoyed it so far.
Okay, great. Thanks, Martin.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got Matt coming up next. And then Casey, please stay on the line. We'll get to you right after Matt. Matt from Bossier City, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes. I was wondering if there are any birds in the area that really reminded you personally of dinosaurs.
Oh, that's a great question. Well, that are local, did you say?
Yeah, start with local if you have any favorites that are, you know, just in general.
Yeah. If you were to go to the Amazon basin, there's a bird called the Hoatzin. It's spelled Hoatzin. Again, Hoatzin. I encourage people to go to Google Images and look for that. That one, to me, looks very prehistoric. But around here, I would say the Roadrunner kind of looks like a Velociraptor that you'd see on Jurassic Park. You know, but he's feathered and he's small, but he's pretty bad. And I mean, as in a, you know, pretty fierce predator, they can take out full-grown rattlesnakes and other venomous snakes. So I think the Roadrunner might be my answer for locally, and then globally the Hoatzin. But that's a cool question. I like it. Did the new installment of Jurassic Park have anything to do with that, Matt?
No, actually, I ponder these things a lot. I just happened to realize that a new movie of Jurassic Park is going on at the time, but not related.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great question. Hopefully you like the answer. So appreciate that. And I'm going to think about that some more every time I'm looking at birds. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Hey, bye.
Bye.
Well, how about the California condor? I mean, would you consider
they're just
that?
Ugly.
They're just ugly.
Yeah. any bird that's got a bare naked head and funky colors like that is ugly. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we go next to Casey from Shreveport. Casey, what's your question tonight?
Hi, Cliff. I actually was listening to a broadcast of y'all's kind of back in the fall of 2015, and you'd mentioned then a woodpecker that's kind of, you know, native to this region of our country, primarily black with a white chest and I think a little bit of a red crest there on top of its head. And you were telling us then at the time that it was kind of on the endangered species list, or it may have been a protected species. And oddly enough, kind of back then, about a week after that broadcast, I had seen one in the backyard of where I was living at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if there was an update on kind of what their status was as a species.
Okay, well, let's get some terms that tackled first. So protected, all the woodpeckers that we have, and there's 8 or 9 species in the listening area, they're all protected. So that means there's federal and state laws that protect them. So the other word used is endangered. And the only one that we would have talked about that's big, black and white with a red crest was the ivory-billed woodpecker. And that bird is the one that hasn't been seen in a long, long time. And there is another bird here. Okay, Bill's playing the call note of the ivory-billed here. This was recorded in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Near Monroe, Louisiana. Sounds like a little boy's tooting trumpet.
Yeah.
So that bird's not around, but there's a lookalike, and Bill's going to look up the pileated woodpecker, and that's what I bet you saw.
Okay.
And so there are plenty of pileateds around. Now, they're protected, but they're not endangered. They're very common.
Okay.
And so I'm guessing you had the pileated woodpecker. It's big and black and white with a red crest.
Correct.
Yeah. So I guess the message is, and I would have said this in 2015, my feeling is that there are these two big woodpeckers. They're often confused since they kind of look alike, but we should always go with the expected one unless you've got some way to document that you've
Correct.
Got the rarity. So have your cell phone ready to grab the sound, have your camera ready to grab a picture. Otherwise, you know, telling people you saw an ivory billed is like saying you saw Elvis or Bigfoot. No one's gonna believe you until you got proof. So, but until then, we should just go with the expected one, and that's the pileated woodpecker. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks
cool.
for correcting
All right, Casey. Thank you.
And just so you know, I saw Elvis up in Branson not too long
ago. Oh, how'd he look?
Well, he was younger. Give us a call, 800-552-8502, if you have a question for Cliff. Cliff is our resident ornithologist tonight on Bird Calls, and we're willing to take your calls right now, 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to JC from Longview. JC, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, I may have already missed it, but when the gentleman called in about the dinosaur appearing birds, did you bring up the pileated woodpecker?
I didn't. I don't think they look very dinosaur-like. I mean,
really? They don't look just like a pterodactyl to you?
No, I don't think they do. I mean, I can't get Woody Woodpecker out of my mind when I see a pileated. So I just think see this this mischievous little cartoon character. So,
gotcha.
But no, that's a subjective question. It's a good one. And, you know, if they look that way to you, I think there's no wrong answer to that.
While I've got you, can I follow up with another one somewhat related? And the gentleman before me may have brought this up. What are your thoughts on whether or not the ivory bill was actually seen up at the White River in Arkansas?
I don't think that they provided enough proof to convince me that that's what they saw.
Okay.
You know, and there were so many years, so much manpower up there that I just never got that money shot that made me realize that that's exactly what they saw. So I would love to be in the camp of, you know, that ivory bill still exists, but I remain a skeptic. I think we've messed things up for that one. And actually I've tied it into my conservation tip at the end of this hour. So I will talk about ivory bills in a sentence or two later. So stay tuned for that.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Thanks JC.
So
yep.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we can take your calls right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to William from Bossier City. William, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
What are owls predators?
What eats owls? Is that the question?
Yes.
You know, if you're a predator and you're larger than an owl, you could, easily eat an owl. So an owl that lands on the ground and all of a sudden a bobcat hops out of the bushes, you would be a predator of an owl, wouldn't you? So, there's nothing that only eats owls in our area. So let's make that real clear. And that's pretty typical of most of your predators. They're opportunistic. So if the opportunity arises for a bobcat that's hiding in the bushes, and here comes a barred owl that swoops down and grabs a mouse or a crawfish or a frog, that bobcat's taking that opportunity to get that barred owl. He's predating it, right? So that would be one example. Now, smaller owls are reportedly a problem for larger owls. So I've seen accounts of great horned owls eating eastern screech owls. So you can have owl against owl, but it's a size thing. So does that help there, William? Does that answer your question?
Yes.
All right. How old are you, William?
8.
8 years old. All right. And you're listening to the radio. Good for you. Hey, thanks for your call, William.
Thank you, William. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we've got phone lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to John from Toledo Bend. John, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, Cliff.
Yes.
I'm up here on Toledo Bend.
Are you on the Texas side or the Louisiana side?
I'm on the Louisiana side, just about out. A half a mile away from the dam.
So would you say you're on the good side or the bad side of Toledo Bend?
Well, I think half of it's right and half of it's wrong, brother.
Well, I guess wherever you are, you're on the good side, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
I'm on the Louisiana side of
it. Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, the good side.
Yes, sir.
But I don't want to aggravate them Texas heads, you know. They're just across the river.
That's right.
Well, we got an island out here. It was beautiful and pristine for years, and a flock of birds have come in, and they killed it. from their defecation.
Hmm.
That's what everybody's telling me. I was thinking it's pine beetles.
Hmm.
And I said, and I've been watching over the year and over the years, and it's about 2 or 3 years, and they've killed the whole damn island, and it's a whole flock of birds in there. The pelicans come every year. There's 100 of them over by that island.
Uh-huh.
So the
vegetation's dead on the island?
Oh, all the big old pine trees, bro.
Yeah. Yeah.
I seen one at Lake Fork one time like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen rookeries where the cattle egrets will, you know, after several years might kill shrubs and things, but I'm a little dubious of big giant pines killed by bird poop.
I'll give you my address and I'll show you.
No, that's the water levels can have a lot to do with it. You know, we get these weird wet cycles and all of a sudden those pines are underwater too long. And then we get these dry cycles, they're not getting enough water. So pines on the edge of a river or a reservoir are always very vulnerable to this.
No, this is on a rock island out in the middle of the lake.
Okay. Well, so then here's the next question. What do you see out there? Is there a rookery out there?
Yeah, I don't know what a rookery is, but they're coming out of trees.
Okay.
Yeah, they're just a bunch of birds.
A rookery, okay, I do know where a rookery is on the Texas side, just north of the Pendleton Bridge. That's the Highway 21. But you're talking about on the Louisiana side. Well, you know, it'd be worth looking to see what kind of birds are using those trees and how long they're doing it. So if there's a lot of cormorants in the winter or cattle egrets this time of the year, it could be a problem, but it usually takes years and years to kill a big tree like that.
No, it's not a tree, it's a whole island.
Yeah. And
they killed every tree on the island.
Right, right. Well,
I'm thinking it might be pine beetles.
Yeah, I just don't think the birds did it. And I know, I've seen it happen with buttonbush and smaller trees, but it's really tough to kill, you know, big old trees like what you're describing. But,
So the pine beetle got it, and everybody's saying it's a bird.
Yeah, it could.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's tough to ID that kind of stuff over the radio.
I'll tell you what, I'll get on in the canoe, and I'll send you some pictures.
Okay, very good. Cool. Yeah, thank you.
We'll be done with that.
Okay, thank you, John.
All right, man, thank you.
Thanks.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. And we have a caller on this line, not sure who it is, so go ahead. That caller is gone, okay. So we will go next to Edwina from Nacogdoches. Edwina, you're on line with Cliff. Go ahead and give us your question. All right, hang on here, Edwina. I'm locked in there for a reason, and we're going to try you over here, Edwina. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
And I wish I had someone that could come out to my place and be a bird watcher for me. I can't find a lot of the birds in my bird books.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? What do you have any examples for me today?
I have a number of sparrows and whatnot. And my other question is, I have two different size cardinals, which have really got me puzzled because I have the standard size and then I have what's like a miniature.
Huh.
And I can't find them in my bird books.
Okay. Well, tell me about the color of the miniature.
Look just like a regular cardinal that I'm used to seeing when I lived in Baton Rouge.
Okay.
But I can't find them. Anything that says anything about there being two different sizes?
Yeah, there's not. I mean, the big difference is going to be in color between the males and the females.
Well, I know the difference between the males and the females, but their sizes, it's like as if I had a baby. These were baby birds, but they're full colored.
Yeah.
Like a regular bird.
Okay, there's two other reddish color or birds that have red on them that are maybe a little smaller. The house finch. You might look up the house finch. He doesn't have a crest, though, but
crests on them, just like a regular cardinal.
Okay, well, then I can't think of anything that's smaller that's red with a crest. There's a summer tanager that's all red, no crest.
Well, these have crests on them. And
okay.
And I wish somebody could come out and play bird watchers at my house.
Yeah, that would be fun. Now, there's an all-gray bird at the feeder with a crest that's the tufted titmouse, but he's not red.
I know the titmouse.
Okay. Yeah, then I don't know what to tell you. You definitely need someone to come out there and tell you what birds you've got at your feeder. Or maybe take pictures. Have you tried to take any photographs?
I'm so old that I'm not used to using the modern technique.
Right. Well, okay, well, keep trying. That'll give you a good homework project to try to identify these strange birds.
Well, I've been trying. Birds. I've got several volumes old ones and new ones, and I still can't find them in my bird book.
Yeah. All right.
I need some help.
Okay. Well, get me some photos. That's the best we can do on the radio.
Okay.
Thank you, Edwina.
Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Nicole. Nicole, you're online with Cliff. Well, there we go. We lost that one, too. And we're going to go next to Steve Tyler from Tyler. Oh, what's your question, Steve?
Yes, I'd like to go back to pileated woodpeckers.
Okay.
I wondered how they're doing population-wise overall in the Arklatex region. I live in Tyler, and my wife and I used to see them and hear them in Tyler right in our neighborhood, but we have not seen them in the last maybe 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, they're doing fairly well. I mean, they've certainly become adaptable to urban settings. I've got them in my backyard, but I don't see them every day in my backyard, I think, because it takes a lot of square blocks of an urban area to accommodate them. So we'll go weeks and weeks without seeing them. But I think overall, pileateds are doing pretty good. And I wouldn't worry about that one going as quick as, say, the wood thrush that we talked about earlier, for sure.
Okay, so, thanks. I'm glad to hear they're doing well. And then one other question along the same lines. Owls in urban areas, what are the usual types? I hear them sometimes, but what are the usual types you would hear, like, in a city of that has population but big trees?
In this listening area, there are three that come to mind: the great horned owl, the barred owl, and the eastern screech owl. And Bill's got vocalizations of all those. So let's play. That's the begging baby great horned. Here's the adult great horned. Real deep hoots. Let's do the barred owl. I can imitate that one. We don't need a recording for that one. Move on.
And you want the screech owl.
And the screech owl. I can do that one, too. Well, my mouth is dry. I got to get a swig of water to do that one. Got to get a nice little loogie going. It's a trilling whistle, and people hear that at night. So that's a great question, the owls of the listening area.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have all lines open right now, 800-552-8502. George from Bossier is next. George, what's your question?
My question is about bird behavior between Mississippi kites and hawks. I watched these Mississippi kites diving on a hawk the other day, and I'm wondering if they I didn't think they fed on the same food source. Is that normal behavior?
Yeah, I've seen broadwing hawks eat some of the same things that Mississippi kites, and they will kind of compete, and of course swallowtail kites. But if you're, if it's a big chunky raptor like a red-shouldered or red-tailed hawk, no, they're not going to do much overlap. But I have seen the same thing. I think that the smaller, more agile kite is just messing around. He's just trying to command more airspace and saying, move on. This is my airspace. You get on out of here. So that's the kind of attitude I get when I see these more agile kites chasing a bigger hawk. So is that maybe what you're seeing, George?
Well, there was two of them diving vertically in a V on hawk. And I just wondered, the other thing is, they don't seem to come back to the same territory. Or the Mississippi kites, are they summer birds?
Yeah.
And the hawks, winter birds?
Well, some of the hawks, like red shoulder and red tail, are year-round, and then the Mississippi kite is only with us in the warmer months. Now, when a bigger hawk gets close to the nest of a Mississippi kite, boy howdy, they will dive bomb because they're being good parents. So you may have seen the parents dive bombing the hawk that got too close to the nest with the fragile young. Yeah, I bet you that's maybe a possibility. So, again, Mississippi kites are only here in the warmer months, and so you're only going to see them right now. They're going to leave us in September, and they won't come back until April.
Okay, thank you very much, man.
Thanks, George.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Gary from Lufkin. Gary, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Oh, thanks. Well, it's a who's who question. I was at a red light a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
And this black bird, little black bird, had a yellow bib.
Uh-huh.
Just standing there, right? And it was fresh cut grass.
Yep.
And then next thing I know, he picks down and he picks something up. Looks like either clipping or may have been a bug, but I think it was a clipping. Anyway, this other bird lands, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this dude automatically just opens his mouth. I mean, points right to the sky and opens his mouth. And the other one starts putting stuff in the mouth. Are they making the question is who's picking it? Who's picking up the branches? And are they making a nest?
Now, I think you saw mom feeding young food, and I think
he was the same size.
Yeah, the young birds when they leave the nest are typically with birds like the European starling, which I think is the bird you had because you described a dark bird with a yellow bill. That's European starling, and they are in our cities, and I see them near the intersection when I'm sitting in a red light. And they'll go down the ground, and the young is going to be 90-something percent the same size. He's just not going to have the yellow bill.
Yeah.
And so Junior came in with a big wide mouth open, and she fed it. So you don't ever have birds exchanging sticks. They're going to grab a stick with their feet or their bill, well, usually with their beak, and fly off and put it in a nest. So you don't see them handing it to each other. They don't have union lines or
So the baby so essentially baby bird's doing the same thing he did in the nest.
Yes, but now he's
there. I mean, that's what it looked like. He was straight open, wide open. I mean, ready. I mean, he was ready for just about anything.
And now he can fly. He can follow mom and dad.
Following mama daddy, whatever it was.
And he's dependent on mom and dad, like that 17, 18-year-old kid that won't leave the house. But they're following mom and dad, and they're also watching mom and dad, not only getting the free food, but seeing how to get food. So it's a learning experience, too.
Right on.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, good. You saw.
Well, hey, before I go, I just want to let you know that I like y'all's show.
Great.
I had the coolest thing about a week ago. I was on my motorcycle.
Uh-huh.
And I was down a little old all-top road.
Yep.
And I turned a little curve, and I'll be dang, out of nowhere, here comes this hawk. And he was about 10, maybe 8 or 10 foot ahead, above me.
Mm-hmm.
And he just went sailed across like an airplane. That was the coolest thing I ever seen.
That's neat. That's neat. He would have messed you up if you guys connected along your route.
Yes,
wouldn't? Yeah.
Yes, sir, but we were both going the same way.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, all right. Y'all have a good day.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Four of our five lines are open, so you can get right in. And we go next to our last caller online right now, Lisa from Longview. You're online with Cliff. What's your question?
I was recently in Spain, and I was fascinated by the storks. Are storks found anywhere except Europe and North Africa?
Well, if you were intrigued by them being on the rooftops and putting their nests on the rooftops and chimney tops, we don't have any storks that do that in the U.S. So we do have the wood stork that occurs in the listening area, and you can find those this time of the year and on into August, September, October in wetlands. But if you liked what you saw there, that doesn't translate over here to the U.S., no. So, yeah, okay. We don't have anything like that. Yeah,
and the nests were huge. They were 6 feet wide.
Oh, yeah. It's a big bird, and that bird is only occurs over there and doesn't occur over here. And, yeah, they embrace them, and I think that's where the old wives' tale of the stork bringing the baby came from. So if you're interested in that folklore, that's your bird right there. You should look that up and study up on the stork delivering the baby, the human baby.
Okay. Thank you.
I was just going to ask that. You mean we don't have any baby deliverers here in the U.S.?
Yeah. Oh
my gosh, how are we going to increase our population? You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Four lines are open right now, so you'll get right in. We go next to James from Longview. James, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Last year, either in April or May, when we were having those series of storms coming through, I was sitting out in the backyard, and all of a sudden I heard this commotion and looked up in one of my oak trees. And you want to talk prehistoric bird, out flies this pterodactyl-sized thing. Hmm. It wasn't an owl, and it wasn't a hawk. It was. So I asked my wife, because it was kind of looking off, and she said it might have been a golden eagle. Are they around this area?
No, that's a tough one to find. Okay. You would really have to... You'd have to look through a lot of birds to see a golden eagle in our listening area. They are here. I've seen it two or three times. I know bird watchers that have been birding longer than me that have not seen them in the listening area. So that's not – I would not expect that. And the storms certainly wouldn't have anything to do with that. That's going to be more of a western species, you know, in where I live in my state. And so that's – probably not what you had. I don't know what you had, but it was not probably a golden eagle.
One other quick question.
Okay.
What do hummingbirds eat besides nectar?
They eat insects. So okay. Tiny little gnats, the kind that you're walking in your yard and there's this big plume of hundreds of gnats and you have to close your mouth, otherwise you're going to inhale 60 or 70 of them. That's right. Those are perfect food items for the hummingbird, and probably 10-15% of their diet for the adult is going to be made up of that. They need protein, so the nectar it's not 100% of their diet. I mean, think about it. They've got to have protein. Now, when those adults are feeding young, most of that food is going to be protein. So when an adult is feeding a youngster hummingbird in the nest, it's going to be closer to 100% insects for protein. So that's the answer to the question. It's going to be small insects, usually stuff on the wing.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Good deal.
Okay.
Thank you,
James.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. All lines are open right now, so you can get right in. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And in the meantime, we did have some photos submitted online before the show, and the first one is on our website at redriverradio.org. Just click on the Bird Calls post for this week's show. And this was submitted by Jim Brown from Tyler, Texas. And Cliff, can you tell us two birds in a photo?
Yeah.
Can you tell us what they are?
And it's a cool photo because it's looks like a driveway, looking out a driveway down to a road. And there are two greater roadrunners on his driveway. And so clearly he's got a nesting pair. These are adults with super long tails. And that's really neat. These are the greater roadrunner. That's the one I mentioned earlier when the guy asked what I thought looked prehistoric or what looked like a dinosaur, the roadrunner, and that's what this guy sent pictures of. And so they're very low density in the listening area. You have to go a long ways before you see another pair or another roadrunner, but they're here in the listening area, but they're just not very common. They're not very widespread, but they are present. So that's the greater roadrunner.
And we also had another image, and this was submitted by Michaela Lynn Briggs from over near Uncertain, Texas. I believe she took this on the sidelines of or on the coastline of Uncertain there.
Yeah, and it's a neat picture because the bird is sitting on a Spanish moss-laden limb, and it's got a lot of greenery in the background and the gray moss in the foreground, and the bird is just spectacular. It's a red-shouldered hawk. And very chestnutty and very beautiful bird. So that's an adult red-shouldered hawk, yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. We have still time for phone calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go into Mary Ann from Gladewater. You're online next. Mary Ann, what's your question tonight?
I want to tell you all how much I love the show.
Great.
If I could make the comment so I don't forget the second one, then you could answer them if that's all right.
Okay.
I'm wondering if the pterodactyl-like bird might have been a caracara, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I used to see them when I lived down in Brookshire outside Houston.
Uh-huh.
They looked a lot like an eagle.
Yep.
They if you see them flying, they hover. Like a hummingbird, but they're large and they're mostly dark.
Right.
And also, for the gentleman with the trees dying on the island, Texas A&M sponsors, with our tax dollars, we pay for an urban forester.
Okay.
And you can have them out to your property to check your trees, and they may know what's happening with that island if it's in Texas.
Yeah, he said it was in Louisiana.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was on the Louisiana side of the Sabine River. And then those urban foresters, they're not going to probably go out into the sticks where this guy was, because you're talking about getting in a boat and tootling along to get to it, and that's definitely not an urban setting. But you're right. And then the caracara is, I think you're right, that is a good prehistoric looking bird. That caller, according to my notes, was calling from Longview, and caracaras are probably not going to be found in the Longview area very abundantly, but it's still a possibility.
I think
we get a little too excited about storms from Hollywood, and it just doesn't, it's not going to produce something like a golden eagle or crested caracara. When we have birds really shifting around from storms, it's going to be stuff that is picked up out of the Gulf and moved inland. Things like magnificent frigate bird, bridal tern, brown pelican, royal tern, laughing gull, these kinds of things are moved inland. But storms in general, you know, most birds are going to wait them out. They're not flying around. Golden eagle's not going to be flying around in your average storm anyway. He's going to be waiting it out because there's tremendous risk with being aloft when there is a storm, and you've got branches and things that could break your wings. So most birds wait out storms. They're not flying around in a tremendous storm like what I'm guessing people are thinking about that are bringing birds into our area. Okay.
But
cool. All right.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Marianne. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. We have time for maybe one or two more calls, and we've got lines open right now. We're going to go next to Leon, but first, our number is 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Leon from Bossier City, you're back online with Cliff. Hello,
yes,
Leon.
Sir.
Yes.
Welcome back, Leon. We had you. Yeah, all right.
You talked about the Roadrunner. You called him Major Roadrunner?
Greater. Yeah,
greater.
Yep.
Is there a minor Roadrunner?
There is a lesser Roadrunner, and it doesn't occur in the U.S. You have to go down to the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico to see that one. And I know that because my wife and I just got back about a week ago from the Yucatan birding, and that was one of my target birds. I thought, you know, I've seen so many greater roadrunners. It's time to see the lesser roadrunner. Not much different, little smaller, has different markings on the throat, but overall looks just like its northern cousin. But we did not see the lesser roadrunner. We heard one. We couldn't get it to come out. The kind of that scrubby chaparral that he was occurring in down there, not far from Rio Lagartos, Mexico. But there is a lesser roadrunner, and I wish I have seen one, but I have not. Guess I'll just have to go back down to Mexico.
Well, that's news to me. Yep. The greater roadrunner.
Yeah, and we have to apply modifiers to these birds that have multiple species, because it'd be just like calling everybody with a last name Smith. And we need to know, is it Jim Smith or Joe Smith? So we have to give other name. We have to give a modifier to the birds, right, when there's multiple species of roadrunners. So here's some other examples. We have the cardinal. It's the only one in our listening area, but it's correctly known as the northern cardinal because there are several other species of cardinals on the planet. But in our area, it's just the one, so we get away with it, with calling it by the name cardinal. But its correctly full name is northern cardinal.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, all right.
Okay, hey, the roadrunner in Spanish, do you know that?
The paisano.
Paisano.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep, that's it, yep. And the chaparral that I mentioned is a habitat, that's also a colloquial name for the roadrunner as well.
Yes.
Yep, very
thank
good.
You. You're so interesting to listen.
All right, thank you, Leon.
All right, and we're going to go to our last call, Ann from Longview. Ann, we need your question very quickly.
Well, I saw what I thought was the dumbest bird today. Mm. I was in the middle of a big parking lot, and they had separated the parking lot with these islands with trees and mm-hmm. bushes in them. But on the ground, they'd covered it with rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got out of my car, I noticed there was a bird sitting on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely sitting on the ground, and it was kind of brown, kind of matched the rocks, and it had two black rings around its neck. It had a white throat
mm-hmm.
and two black rings. Well, I went on in the restaurant to my luncheon,
mm-hmm.
and I came out than an hour later, and that bird was still there, and another one flew in, and it stood up, and I could see that bird was sitting on four eggs.
Oh,
all right, and we've got to go. So, Cliff, real quick.
It's a killdeer. Yeah, she had a killdeer nesting pair, killdeer. So look that one up, Ann. That's a great bird. Good sighting. Thanks for the call.
All right, and Cliff, we always close with a conservation tip. Could you give us our conservation tip for this month?
Yeah, habitat fragmentation means taking a larger block of land and carving it into smaller pieces. An example of habitat fragmentation would be taking a larger forest stand and blazing a new road or pipeline through it, which creates openings and edge in a once dense stand of trees. Internationally speaking, many species of birds that need large tracts of intact habitat are in serious decline because it's becoming harder and harder to find. Common bird species that can live in clearings and along forest edges tend to be increasing in numbers. Avoid habitat fragmentation. If you can do that, you'll benefit a lot of species, including the wood thrush that we profiled near the beginning of this episode. Meadowlarks and bobwhite, for example, need large, unfragmented grasslands. Many treetop songbirds need large, unfragmented forests. The ivory-billed woodpecker, now extinct, is a perfect example of this. One pair of ivory bills reportedly needed a minimum of 10,000 acres of contiguous mature forest habitat to survive, which is nearly impossible to find today, and the one reason why the species no longer exists on the planet. On your property, avoid fragmenting that native pasture or that patch of woods at all costs. Instead, work to add that new road or pipeline along existing edges instead of removing important wildlife habitat. This will keep wildlife habitat larger, more intact, and better for a lot of declining species. Do it for the birds.
All right, Cliff, thank you so much for joining us again for this program.
Enjoyed it. Thank you, Bill.
You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and he is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We want to thank those folks for lending Cliff and his expertise to us. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana and is brought to you by the Piney Woods Audubon Society of Nacogdoches Lufkin, educating people and protecting birds for over four decades. The Piney Woods Audubon Society is seeking new members and meets the first Thursday of each month, September through May. Information available at the Piney Woods Audubon on Facebook. Our next program will be one day later next month. It'll be Wednesday, August 15th for Bird Calls. Our program produced tonight by Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford. Tim Schnell, Wally Derleth, and Sheila Lawrence answered our calls, and we want to thank everybody for calling in on the program tonight. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next.